This week on the Special Ed Strategist.
And I do a lot of work on social media and through other platforms, just spreading the word about neurodiversity affirming practices, which is really my passion. Yeah. In contrast to the neurodiversity affirming paradigm and lens, there's the pathology paradigm, which really looks at neurodiversity as something that's wrong with the individual. That truly, it's not a super popular, it's becoming more known, but it's not a widely known topic. So you may be the first to be educating a team about the neurodiversity affirming movement. So also
you're giving them that team.
Exactly. Exactly. It really is. It was a gift when I first learned about it. I was like, whoa, this is amazing. Teachers have gotten generally pretty good at having, you know, restorative conversations or things like that in their classroom. But one of the issues is that we have them and it ends up kind of calling the kid out. So those are be like kind of the first steps that I take and I advise people to take when we're talking about making the shift towards neurodiversity affirming.
Hello and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today we are talking to Bria Rosa, an educational psychologist, a fierce advocate for neurodivergent students, the founder of Neurodiversity Affirming School Psychologist Group, and someone who's on a mission to transform educational practices through a neuroaffirming lens. We're diving into what is neuroaffirming, how we can align neuroaffirming and weave that into our IEPs and provide better support for school and home. So welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, you bet. So for folks that may not be familiar or are new to your work, can you just introduce yourself, share what led you to this space?
Absolutely. So I am a school psychologist and licensed educational psychologist in California. I work in the Los Angeles area. I currently work full-time in a local public elementary school, and I also have my own private practice where I provide assessments for students as well as advocacy work for some families. I also provide education and professional development for educators in the space. And I do a lot of work on social media and through other platforms, just spreading the word about neurodiversity affirming practices, which is really my passion. Yeah.
And such a needed practice and need to get it out. And so hopefully our conversation today is going to help with that mission. Before we start, can you tell me one thing that you love to do? It may be a hobby, a fun pastime, it could be a sport. It doesn't necessarily align with what you're known for professionally.
What do I love to do? I love to do a lot of things, but right now, my husband and I just bought a home and our house has a pool. So we live in Southern California and I have been loving, we've had some really warm days. So I've been loving laying by the pool. That has been my number one thing.
Delicious. I am jealous. Yeah. My husband and I lived in Florida before we had babies. Well, we had our oldest there and then moved back to the DC area and we had a pool and it's nice just to pop out, even just for a second, to have that delicious sunshine and kind of regroup, get that vitamin D. So recharging for sure.
Yes, it's lovely. I'm obsessed.
So let's start with the foundation here. Okay. So can we just talk about what is neuroaffirming and kind of lead to what is ableism and what can we do with all of that? We're going in hot. We're going from relaxing by the pool to let's do it.
The ableism. Yeah. Sounds good. No. So neurodiversity affirming. Yeah, we got to kind of like back up. So neurodiversity, right? So neurodiversity is this idea that there's a whole range, a spectrum of different types of minds. And that's totally normal. That variation in minds, in brains, in behavior is a totally normal part of human diversity. And so to be neurodiversity affirming means that you recognize that that's just a fact of life, that there are differences in brain and behavioral functioning, that you accept this and that you embrace it and that you support people who are neurodivergent, who have brains that are different than dominant society. And you recognize that they have unique strengths and unique support needs. It's very focused on listening to lived experiences and uplifting people from the neurodivergent community as experts on their own brains, their own minds, their own experiences, and really honoring those experiences. So being neurodiversity affirming is really accepting, honoring that people have different brains, have different minds, and also being willing to reflect and learn and continue to grow and evolve in understanding from the neurodivergent community.
And then what is that term ableism and how does that intertwine with this?
Yeah, so ableism is kind of the opposite of affirming, right? It's pathologizing. Ableism comes from the pathology paradigm, and it's more of an action that places neurodivergent people as less than and continues to do so.
I think it's important because I want to show the dichotomy of the two so that we can then weave back to how this aligns with parents that are either just getting a diagnosis or kind of trying to take this journey with their kiddo. And then how can we then be better advocates as professionals? And how can parents be better advocates within their IEPs?
Yeah. So ableism is when we, I think it might make more sense to talk about, sorry to take you in a different direction, but I think it might make more sense to talk about like the pathology paradigm.
Yeah, let's do it.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And then talk about like ableist practices.
Yes.
And like what ableism, how that like comes into play.
Perfect.
In contrast to the neurodiversity affirming paradigm and lens, there's the pathology paradigm, which really looks at neurodiversity as something that's wrong with the individual and something that needs to be changed and fixed and cured and something that the individual needs to change about themselves. The neurodiversity affirming lens is, again, just very accepting, embracing, looking at how we can accept them as a society, how we can better support them. And then the pathology paradigm is very much how they can be, how the individual can change to be fixed.
I am totally feeling this on a personal level. As I have mentioned here, we have three boys. My middle son is a brain cancer survivor. And I so clearly remember, so after his surgery, he spent 40 days in the hospital and then 2 years of intensive outpatient. And I remember days with my youngest on my hip because he was still tea tiny and wasn't ready for school yet. And so just, you know, doing all the mom stuff and different therapists would kind of just at the end of each session recap. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation because some were framing his work and his needs and all of that in just more of a positive, supportive way. And some were different in their approach, that kind of more of that pathology paradigm. And there were so many times that I was just like, I don't even want to talk and hear at the end of this session because I'm just so tired of hearing what he can't do. And as a mom heart, I want to hear what he can do. And then as my mind's racing through this important start to our podcast, is that how this affects the student that's sitting in an IEP meeting or standing next to a parent that's hearing this information just on an unconscious level, right? So I don't even know where my next question is. I just was like, all of this, right? And so what can we do? You know, I guess let's start with what does it mean, you know, if we're going to start to put this in education and how is this different than from our current special education models?
Yeah. Well, I think what you said is very powerful. I think it does have a really big impact, obviously on a personal level, right? For the individual who's hearing about it, it's a lot. It feels very heavy when you're hearing negative things about your child, about yourself, myself included. I'm also neurodivergent. And, you know, I was diagnosed by my psychiatrist who was trained in through a medical model, right? So the information that they present to me is through a pathology paradigm, just like I was trained through a medical model and educators are trained through a medical model. And our society sends messages through a medical model because that is the dominant model in our society. So that is typically how our messages are sent to us. So it's very hard and it's very harmful to people who are different, who are disabled, who are neurodivergent personally. But research also shows that it's very harmful. We know that it is harmful to mental health, but on the opposite side, we know that using a strength-based perspective is research-based, has really positive outcomes on mental health, on academic achievement, on graduation rates, on post-secondary achievement. So it's so important that not only that we stop using this deficit focus, right? And talking about what students are doing wrong, what children are doing wrong, what is wrong with the child, what challenges they have, but that we really focus on their unique strengths and their support needs. We don't want to ignore their support needs, of course, right? We're not trying to just sugarcoat everything and make everything a strength, because that's not true either. But we can reframe their needs in terms of what they need for support rather than their challenges and things they need to change. I think in general, we have to move forward in making those shifts so that families feel more supported, that children and you know, young adults and adolescents start feeling more supported, because that's the only way our society and societal messages are also going to start shifting to become more inclusive too.
So what does that practice look like?
It's a slow practice.
Yeah, exactly, right. Because you're really taking this long-standing educational indoctrine, so to say, and now we want to create this mind shift for professionals, to support parents, to ultimately support the kiddos that we are supporting, whether they're our personal kiddos or the kiddos that we support in our practices. So what are some examples of a strength that may be overlooked in that traditional model? Or what are some examples when you say strength that we could reframe to?
Yeah, honestly, the first thing that I always say is start with language shifts. So some people are like, oh, shifting language, that's not the first place to start. Actually, I think it is the first place to start, because when you start shifting your own language, you start believing it too. So even if you're not totally sure, or you're interested, but you don't fully know exactly what to believe, but you know you want to do something better, just start shifting your own language and you'll start to believe it too, right? And then other people will start to believe it too. So for example, rather than saying deficits in social language, you could say differences in social language. For example, if you're talking about an autistic individual, because there's also a lot of research about autistic social communication and how that's, you know, not really deficient, but just different. So when you start reframing that for yourself, you start believing that and others start believing that too, right? So now you're building a different narrative rather than saying non-compliant. That's another big one, right? We've probably all seen behavior plans or IEPs that say something about non-compliant, right? What about self-advocate or self-directed? Those have a very different connotation. They still mean the same thing. I know what self-directed means. It means doing what you want, right? But it has a very different connotation. And being self-directed is a strength. Not following the rules is a strength. It really is. We want people to be independent learners, don't we? We want people to be thinking for themselves. So when we start reframing that, we start believing that as well. And we start treating kids differently based on what we think about them. So those are be like kind of the first steps that I take and I advise people to take when we're talking about making the shift towards neurodiversity affirming.
And you could see how this is helpful in kind of moving our children into adulthood, because then they're considering themselves in a different view. And then becoming more of that individual that truly represents who they are and who they're meant to be. How does that then, how are teachers or behavior specialists or school staff looking at that language when you're at an IEP table, and how are they either agreeing and on board or giving you a pushback of like, well, what about X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, that's a good question. I will just say, I personally speak with a lot of conviction. I don't personally experience that a ton. I explain the behaviors. I might call them self-directed, and I will say objectively what those behaviors look like. So it might be saying no when, you know, verbally saying no or engaging in a task that is, you know, not what has been assigned. Those are self-directed behaviors. There's not really anything to argue about. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's clear. I'm just calling them self-directed rather than non-compliant. I haven't had anyone say anything different, you know, against that. Same with the differences versus deficits in social communication. I just explain that exactly what I said to you, that autistics tend to communicate well with one another, but not well with neurotypical people. So really they have differences in how they communicate, not necessarily deficits. And I explain that. And generally for me, it goes over fairly well. So I don't typically get a lot of pushback. I'm sure other people do. Perhaps someone who, maybe a parent, for example, who's not regarded as an expert at the IEP table, right? I am. I recognize that at an IEP table as a school psychologist sitting there, I'm the expert at the IEP table generally. Most people regard me as such. So I do recognize that. But I think that parents also hold a lot of weight at an IEP table too, and they just don't really realize that. But yeah, so I think just making a solid argument that, you know, this is what it is, I think usually goes over fine.
I think with that, I was going to then say, how do we empower our parents so that they have that knowledge and that they're able to be that strong member at the IEP table? So I have a course called Cracking the Code that teaches parents how to get an IEP and teaches them how to collect data and on their kiddo and the home and the community so that they can then prioritize and align that into an IEP and into an IEP conversation. And so what would your tip be then for parents that want to take this knowledge and better advocate and have that strength or that power at the IEP table to be, hey, here is some neuroaffirming language, and here is the data that I see at home that is going to, that we need to bring into an IEP to better support the student.
Yeah, well, I definitely think like parent input statements prior to an IEP is just super important, and not enough parents do this. I know for the clients that I work with, for advocacy clients, I'm always like, parent input statement, you guys, come on. But I don't think in my 10 years, I don't think I've ever had a parent do a parent input statement, ever. I mean, it's really wild, but that's very powerful to have a parent input statement to add into an IEP. So I definitely recommend doing that. And I think also just coming into the IEP, sharing things from a neurodiversity affirming approach or before the IEP. I mean, I can't tell you how powerful it is when a parent just sends an email to the team before an IEP. Even just asking for things, asking, can you send me the goals ahead of time? Yeah, absolutely we can. You know, just even basic things like that. Or, hey, I found this article, and sending it to the team is great. Those things are very helpful. So just communicating with the team beforehand is very helpful. Sending them what you find about neurodiversity affirming practices. Hey, I've read about this. Have you heard about this? I listened to this interview, this podcast interview. I've never heard of this before. Have you? You know, just starting that conversation. I have, you know, one pagers, and there are lots out there, but I have one pagers about neurodiversity affirming practices for educators. Send a one pager, right? What does this look like? So just to start broaching those conversations with teams. Also, starting to get the language into IEPs. So if you want, if you know, you have input on the goals that are being written, give your input on the goals that are being written. If they feel like they're focused too much on compliance and they don't align with, you know, centering your child's neurodivergent identity, you have the power to say, this goal doesn't feel right to me. I want to make some changes to it, right? You absolutely have the right to do that. Or if there are accommodations in there that require your child to earn a break or to request sensory materials or, you know, things like that, those aren't accommodations.
I'm sitting here shaking my head for people that are listening.
Those aren't accommodations, you guys. Access to a token board is not an accommodation, okay? So we please, like, look through those things and speak up. Those things aren't supposed to be in a child's IEP. And you have a voice and you could say something about it. And this little known fact, supplementary aids and services, you can have parent and teacher training written into IEPs. Okay. You can have this type of training. You can have outside consultants written into IEPs. You could have even like pre-recorded trainings written into IEPs. Anything that will help the team understand your child's disability better. You can have that put into an IEP. You can have very specific things put into an IEP. And if you want that to be through a neurodiversity affirming perspective, you could have that put into an IEP too. So you have parents, you have a lot more power than you might realize. And it's really important that you speak up, that you use your voice. And I think, like, through a collaborative perspective, as much as possible, you want to, probably you're going to be working with a team or at least the district for many years. You want to foster a collaborative relationship as much as you can. Obviously, there are times when that doesn't, you know, doesn't always work that way and you have to push more. But in general, I think kids do well if they can, parents do well if they can, teachers do well if they can. So just trying to keep that in mind. But yeah, you could definitely get, you can get a lot in an IEP, more than you realize. So definitely using your voice and advocating for those things is very important.
And I want to add in that parent of input statement, thinking through, you know, where do you see your kiddo in 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, so that you can kind of keep the rhythm moving forward. And that if there are needs to get on a wait list or complete paperwork for funding or whatever that may be, you can get that started. And things shift, obviously, and ideas and directions that kiddos are going in, but that at least starts kind of the planning forward that IDEA has paved for parents. And I would also like to suggest to parents that are listening that when they're providing their suggestions, to go ahead and try to provide some examples for the team. So if it's, you know, let's look at this goal differently, what about X, Y, and Z, and putting that information in there so that you can create that SMART goal that is also neuroaffirming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know about yours. For my clients, I have like the first part of the parent input statement is like a parent philosophy, right? And it has like a whole thing. And I actually have like it all templated out because my clients are come to me specifically for that neurodiversity affirming perspective, right? So I have it all there and it's very clear about what that is and what that looks like. So it's immediately giving the team some education about what that is. So it's super important that the team understands what that means, what that looks like, and it gives the team a better idea of what you want. And the team may have never heard of neurodiversity affirming. That yeah. Truly, it's not a super popular, it's becoming more known, but it's not a widely known topic. So you may be the first to be educating a team about the neurodiversity affirming movement. So also
you're giving them that team.
Exactly. It really is. It was a gift when I first learned about it. I was like, whoa, this is amazing.
Amazing. Truly. Like, yes, it's just like, whew. All right. Yeah. This makes 1,000%. Like, I get it. Yeah. All right. So now let's educate everybody. And I think by doing that, utilizing what you're saying in terms of like a template, a philosophy, giving the language, because as in my experience, educators and professionals, we love supporting kids. We want to do best by them. And, you know, in the words, I think it was Oprah, right? When you know better, you do better. So then it's just, you know, providing that framework for them to follow, and ultimately then we're better supporting the students as they grow. So are there common, I'm going to kind of switch a little bit to classroom practices. Are there common classroom practices that maybe are unintentionally harmful, or what could we then as a classroom teacher start kind of doing to help shift our messaging and support?
Yeah, there are. I'm going to start with just general practices, a popular, very popular one that's school-wide and behavior or and classroom specific is PBIS, so positive behavior intervention supports. And it sounds great. And I will say, like, I was a huge PBIS advocate, and I have a lot of background in it and a lot of understanding. And since I've embraced the neurodiversity affirming movement, my eyes have really been opened to some of the harmful impacts it has specifically for neurodivergent students. So it really focuses on praising compliance, right? So getting rewarded for staying in your seat, for sitting quietly, for staying in line, all of those types of behaviors, which are very unnatural or can be very unnatural for neurodivergent students. And it can really lead to what's called masking. So when neurodivergent individuals are attempting to act more neurotypical. And when this happens, we know that it can have really harmful impacts to neurodivergent people's mental health, especially over time. So that is one way that it can really invalidate neurodivergent identity. So that's something that is really embedded in our education system. And it can be a hard thing to try to get out. But we also, in classrooms, we do this a lot too, right? A lot of times there are individual reward systems that are used for classroom management. And I understand, like, you're trying to manage an entire classroom and keep everything in line. So I would just encourage teachers to really think about what types of things you are reinforcing and what things you're providing rewards for, what those rewards look like. And really, again, thinking about your neurodivergent students, in what ways could this potentially be causing any harm to the students? So that would be one of the big things that, again, is totally unintentional, an unintentional way that educational settings and classrooms can be causing harm to neurodivergent students.
Could you give us some examples of what that could look like in a classroom in terms of what a more affirming way we could provide that within a classroom setting?
Well, I'm not sure that you really could. I think it's really hard, though, for teachers to move away from it totally if you've been doing it for years. Instead, I think it's really important to do, like, universal design for learning. And so having things super accessible and flexible and engaging, normalizing accommodation tools, right? Having flexible seating, because when you make things more engaging and more accessible, you don't need to have that level of compliance. Kids are already engaged, right? So you won't need those other things, but it does take a different level of understanding and training to kind of get to that point of engagement. And then I'm also a huge fan of Ross Green's collaborative proactive solutions. So that's another huge passion of mine. So doing those, they're called Plan B problem solving conversations, right? So when expectations aren't being met, you can have those conversations as a whole class about, okay, these are my expectations as a class, but those expectations didn't get met. What can we do? Right. So I think there are different ways that you can manage classrooms without going the PBIS behavior reinforcement route. And I've seen it happen and seen it be effective as well. So I absolutely know it can happen, but it does take a different level of skill set, I would say, to be able to do that. But other, you know, I think if you're not quite there yet with your skills as a teacher and doing UDL, which is, again, it's very challenging if you don't have that level of training. I think one of the things that
I... Universal Design Learning.
Yes.
Folks, yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes, UDL is Universal Design for Learning. If you don't fully have that skill set yet, or maybe in your district you have really rigid curriculum and it doesn't allow for a lot of flexibility, that's the case in some districts as well. Maybe you want to do something that is just more flexible. Maybe you're trying to do whole class rewards or, you know, something that just has a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more room for individualism. That isn't so specific, isn't calling out specific students. I mean, please do not have clip charts. Please get rid of those altogether. I still see them. I don't know what's happening. Even PBIS says ditch the clip, but those are still in classrooms. Please get rid of clip charts. Those are clearly harmful and have been very obviously harmful for many years. But yeah, that one is obviously intentionally harmful. But anyway.
The good thing though, is as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, we're here in April and mm-hmm. this is going to come out probably in May, and folks mm-hmm. that are listening, teachers alike, or hopefully that's going to start getting them curious about our conversation.
Yeah.
They're going to roll into summer, and I hope while they're on the beach, relaxing, they're going to be listening to some podcasts, figuring out the next steps. And if I have one little token is choose one thing, right? Let's start yeah. small. So it's not like I'm busting out with everything. And if you are, I think that's super terrific. But if you're like, whoa, this seems like a lot, just pick one thing that you can start and then start to put your head around that and then take another thing so that you can slowly make that shift. Would you say that?
Absolutely.
Fair. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. And that's truly how I started with neurodiversity affirming practices too, because I'll just say it was very overwhelming for me when I first learned about neurodiversity affirming practices. I learned about 4 years ago. So I was shocked. I was truly shocked because I did not realize that what I had been doing for so long was wrong and harmful. And everything that I had been trained to do was wrong and harmful. And I was like, oh my gosh, where do I even start? So truly, you have to start small. You have to focus. And it's like, oh my gosh, but it's not even just me. It's the whole system. It's everything. It's everywhere. It's everyone. It's really, you have to start so small. So just focus on, okay, what can I do? What small thing can I do right now? For me, it was, okay, I can put a blurb in my psychoed reports. That's where I'm going to start. And then it was, okay, I'm going to shift the language when I talk about kids and IEPs. Okay, now I'm going to shift the language in some parts of my reports. Okay, now I'm going to move on to behavior plans. Like it was very small shifts one at a time. And then once I got comfortable, adding a little bit more. I would say the exact same thing for classroom teachers. And there are some great books. There's a really good one that just came out too, Neurodiversity Affirming Classrooms by Emily Kircher Morris, I think.
She has a podcast as well.
She does. Then I think it's the Neurodiversity Podcast. That sounds right. Yeah.
I'm going with it. I'm pretty, yes. Yes, it is. I'm going confident.
Okay. Wonderful. But yeah, I just started reading that, and that's really wonderful too, and very tangible tips for, you know, changes that you can start making into your classroom. So if you're an educator and you're like, well, I don't know where to start, that's definitely a good place to start.
You brought up language. So
yeah.
Why does identity first versus person first language matter?
Yeah, well, it really depends on the community, but the autistic community has just been very clear that they prefer identity first language. They feel that they cannot separate their autism from themselves, from their identity. It's very intertwined, and they generally prefer identity first language, prefer that people use identity first language. Some people within the autistic community do prefer person first. So it's individual, but the default is identity first language, and then making room for individual preferences as well. But for example, the Down syndrome community prefers person first language. So you would say person with Down syndrome in that situation. The ADHD community does prefer identity first. So you would say ADHDer. So, or, you know, if you're autistic and an ADHDer, you might say ADHDer. So there's, you know, there's some nuances, and it can get a little bit confusing. But generally speaking, many in the neurodivergent community do prefer identity first language. And again, it's kind of taking back and embracing their own identity as a neurodivergent person and claiming that as not being bad or wrong or anything that's separate. It's not a person with something, right? It's not like a person with cancer, right? A person with cancer needs to be fixed or cured. A person with autism doesn't need to be fixed or cured. It implies that there's something separate from them, and it's not something separate. It's intertwined with who they are as a person. So that's really kind of the background from my understanding about the importance of identity first language in the communities.
And you can always ask.
Oh yeah.
Prefer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely always ask. But the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network has put out position statements and other organizations that are autistic led as well, who very much have said, please use identity first language and use that as the default. Make room for individual preferences, but to utilize identity first.
Can we talk a little bit about scaffolding or embedding kind of sensory supports, mm-hmm. executive function to help with whether it's co-regulation or just helping in daily routines?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I like to go back to this like universal design for learning and these principles of universal design for learning, but things just like visual schedules, right? Very easy support for executive functioning, for regulation. Having that on the board is so, so helpful for kids and for adults too. When I like pop into a classroom, I'm like, what's going on in here? Oh, okay, good. There's a schedule. I hate when there's not one. As someone who walks into a lot of classrooms all day. But yeah, things like that are just so important and can really support everyone in the classroom. So really trying to think about, okay, what could support everyone in this classroom? Having timers. I love when I go into a classroom too, and like there's a PowerPoint or something on the smart board, and there's a visual timer on that smart board. Why does a student need an individual visual timer on their desk? They don't. Do a whole class one for everyone, right? Warnings before transitions that are a classroom norm rather than a separate special accommodation. Flexible seating that is out and about, like not separate in a separate area. Or same with like fidgets, right? Not in a separate area, but things that are just more readily accessible. Headphones, things like that. Things that are readily accessible that are just embedded and part of that classroom culture.
No, the truth is that there's so many other students and, like you said, adults that can benefit from these elements that it makes sense to do it for all. And it's easy to integrate.
Right. Totally. And obviously, like having something like a calm corner or, you know, something to that effect that anyone can use. Anyone can use this calm corner, maybe having weighted blankets or weighted lap pads, things like that, that are just helpful for anybody, making it really. And I know teachers are sometimes hesitant because they are worried that kids are going to use them as toys or use them incorrectly. This really doesn't happen outside of the first like week. Like yeah. Maybe the first week of school, kids are playing around with it because it's novel, it's new, it's exciting, right? So if you introduce it the first week of school, all kids are going to be interested in these things. But then kids who don't actually need it aren't going to use it anymore. It's not going to be interesting anymore.
That's
it's
right.
Just there. Exactly. Yep. It's just normal. It's just natural. So I would really encourage teachers to actually embed these things in their classroom. Let kids get excited about them. They're going to be excited. They're going to be interested. It's okay. They will get over it. It will stop being exciting, and then it will just be a normal part of the classroom environment. So those things are great. And then I also think making sure that you have time in your schedule for things like classroom community building, restorative circles, again, like that Ross Green Plan B conversations, really embedding those things into your classroom to support the classroom community and to support the problem solving, the perspective taking, the emotion regulation, all of those pieces, but actually putting that time in your schedule is going to be really helpful. So you're not disrupting things or trying to adjust your schedule or make things happen in the moment or be reactive rather than proactive. It will be a lot more helpful if you just kind of have that already embedded in your schedule.
You know, and you can even think of it from a parent perspective in terms of things that you can do in your home, which I'm going to ask a question right after this with that. But once you get it as a habit, like anything that we do, it just becomes super normal. And just, this is part of our classroom culture. This is part of our classroom environment. This is no big deal. This is what we do at home. This is our process. And it just becomes, you know, day to day without a second thought. So there may be a little bit of heavy front loading in terms of thinking ahead, planning, setting up. But then once that rhythm kicks in, it's like, I really do think it saves a lot, both physically, mentally, emotionally, like just it enhances, obviously, the classroom experience and making sure everybody feels that they belong and are seen and are heard.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, neurodivergent kids, there are going to be times where a neurodivergent kid has a meltdown or something happens, right? And teachers have gotten generally pretty good at having, you know, restorative conversations or things like that in their classroom. But one of the issues is that we have them and it ends up kind of calling the kid out. So that's why I say if you just make that kind of part of your classroom routine, right? There's always going to be, you know, every day after morning recess, we always have a classroom circle. It's not anything special. It's not anything different. We always do this. And that's the time where we process, we do a community building, we do whatever it is. It's less of that. It's less of that isolating feeling for that kid if you're processing through what has happened with your class or something to that effect. So that's why I think it's really important that you make that just kind of part of your routine.
So for families that are just beginning this journey, what are some neurodiversity affirming steps that they can take right now? We talked a little bit about teachers, but at home, advocating at school, kind of to support their kiddos' growth, to help them and create that sense of belonging.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, just accepting and loving on your baby, really just leaning into the things that they're interested in, the things that they love, not feeling really, I think what happens, I'm not a parent, so I'll just say what I think happens from all the parents that I've worked with, the thousands of parents I've worked with, is that there's a lot of pressure on parents, especially of neurodivergent kids, to make them act a certain way, make them be a certain way. And my hope for parents is that they get some relief from that, that they don't, their kid is perfect the way they are. And we don't want to change anything about them, that there's nothing about them that needs to be fixed or changed or cured, right? And that they can breathe a little bit easier, that they don't have to push back against their child's natural neurotype, that they can really let their kid be. And, you know, hopefully that would decrease tension in their house and that there's more positive interactions in the house. And that creates this really warm loop in their family. So that's what I would say is really kind of taking a step back. And I think for, especially, I'm going to talk about autistic specifically. I think for parents of autistic children, there's this idea that there needs to be a lot of intervention and a lot of like early intervention. And for some autistic children, this might be true, but not for all autistic children. Not every autistic child needs 40 hours a week of ABA therapy. Okay. That's really hard, really, really hard on children. And the autistic community specifically has been very expressive about how challenging and detrimental that has been. So I guess I would say, really, really think about, what does my kid actually need? Try to drown out the noise from what all the outside people are trying to say. Just because they're professionals does not mean they know your child best. You know your child best. What do you think your child needs? What does your gut tell you about your child? And what kinds of things do you love about your child? What can you lean into? Where can you lean into their strengths, their interests, their unique way of being? And really just focusing on that and letting go of this pressure to try to fix them or to make them different. Just leaning into who they are.
I think a great way to kind of start that process of drowning out the noise is, I've done this with parents, call it a sticky note party, where you just write one thing on different sticky notes, right? Of everything that you're just saying, and then put it up, mm-hmm. kind of creating almost a vision board so that you can start to identify and sort and prioritize so that you then have this bigger picture. So you can take that language that you've gotten out of your head, that gut does not lie, 1,000% mm-hmm. does not lie. We know in our parent gut about our babies. And so by doing this and taking sticky notes and putting it up and kind of figuring it out, then you're better able to articulate to this team, back to the school team, of who your kiddo is, and you can weave that into everything you're doing in the IEP. So you've created this kind of blueprint of your baby and how you see your baby and what they need and all of that in a way that then you can articulate it to advocate.
Yeah, I love that. That's perfect.
So what are some, we've talked about teachers, we've talked about parents. What are some things that we can do to help our students self-advocate?
Oh, I love this. So my issue is that I have too many passions, but this is one of my like big areas of passions too, is talking to kids about their diagnoses, about their neurotype, because this is one area where we really fall short. Truly, we truly fall short. And everyone, and I think part of it is we're concerned about the stigma. And I think this happens on all ends, right? I mean, I know myself as a school psychologist, I think the parent should maybe do that. And I think parents maybe feel like, I don't really know how to talk to my kid about this. And I think everyone just kind of goes, I don't know who's supposed to do this, right? And so no one really talks to the kid, and then they grow up and then they maybe sit in an IEP, but they don't really know what the IEP is for. And it just is a whole mess. It's a whole mess. It's messy. And then they like find out later about it. It's just such a disaster. So I think like early and often, I think we talk to kids, have transparent, developmentally appropriate conversations with kids early on about their neurodivergence and just talk to them about it, especially when we're talking about it through a strength-based affirming lens. It's much more easy for kids to understand it through that lens. We're not talking about it through this medical model, through this deficit lens. So that's my first thing, is like, we really need to be talking to kids about their neurodivergence and just explaining to them about their unique brain, about their unique neurotype, and then even getting more specific to them specifically, right? So, and I typically get consent from parents who most of the time are like, yeah, please talk to my child about this. I don't know what to say. And so I go through, I explain the assessment results, and then I talk about what supports might work for them. And I get their input too. So getting their input on accommodations, I say, this is what I found out through the evaluation. This is what I think would be helpful for accommodations. What do you think? And let them say. If I'm writing goals for them, especially in the area of social emotional, I typically will have them complete a self-assessment of some sort. And then we review it together. And I say, what do you think about this? I'm thinking about a goal related to this area. Do you agree with this? Or is there something specific you wanted to work on? Or I've heard you talk a lot about X. Do you think we should write a goal in this area so we can work on it for the next year? It's also great to do like a strengths inventory. So there's the VIA. I can't remember what it stands for. Something. Inventory assessment. I can't remember that. There's one, and then there's another one that's shorter that the student fills out, and we will review that together. So there's lots of ways that we can help students to get their voice and their input in the IEP, help them understand their neurotype, and then also understand the IEP or the 504 and understand those accommodations so that they can advocate for it. I know for one student, we actually wrote a goal for them that they would be able to identify various situations where they would use the various accommodations, right? And so we would do some like role play because a student was about ready to, he had an IEP and was about ready to move to a 504. We wanted to make sure he was really, really ready for it. So yeah, I think there's a lot of ways that we can support students in that self-advocacy.
And kids will tell you. They'll tell you what's working. They'll tell you what's not working. They'll tell you, you know, I learn best this way. And I think the role playing and the scaffolding is really key for a lot of students so that we can ensure that they then have the voice to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And of course, we want to write goals for kids too that really empower them to self-advocate. So the goals that we write for kids should very much be related to self-advocacy so that we're moving in that direction for kids so that they can be self-advocates and they can understand themselves better and their own needs better. That's very important as well.
So as we wind down today, what is something that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked on our topic?
That's hard because I could talk about this literally all day.
I know. And that's the hard part, right? Like, it's just like just giving a little sliver so that people can then find more knowledge once they listen, kind of starting their journey.
Yeah. I think we touched on a lot of great things. I think we could have probably gone more in depth about affirming IEP goals. That's what I talk about a lot. And I like to say that the goals of an IEP are really like the bread and butter of an IEP, right? Because it starts with goals, which drive the services. So that's one thing. And I do post about that quite a bit. And there are other resources too. But yeah, I would say IEP goals, talking about how we can make those more affirming and also making sure that they're still SMART goals, but that they really focus on the child's neurotype so that everyone is really understanding the child through this perspective and focusing on goals that are really going to support the child, that are meaningful for the child, that are strength-based and leveraging strengths. Yeah, that would be one thing that I would say. We could probably spend many hours on that. I actually just did a workshop on it. So I know we could spend hours on it.
It is a lot, right? I mean, if you think about this, even when you're in school, you take a course just on IEPs. So, but to then take that to the next level to make sure that they are neuroaffirming, they're individualized, is incredibly important. I might have to do a solo episode on that, but you're right. We could just keep going for sure. My last question is, if you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. If I had a billboard, one tip for parents, honestly, it would be do the best you can until you know better. And when you know better, do better, because we're all just out here doing the best we can. Okay. And that's all you can do. That's all you can do. I mean, that's all I can do. That's all anyone can do. And just don't be hard on yourself. Just keep moving forward. Just keep doing the best you can. That's it. That's truly it. That's kind of my motto. And I think that should be everyone's motto.
What an excellent way to end our conversation. How can folks find you or find more resources about this topic?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on Instagram. My handle is at ND_affirming_SP.
And that will be in the show notes as well. I love it. Thanks for joining us, and you have a good day. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.